Audible Inc. presents Black River, written by Dean Koontz, read by Scott Brick.
In a single eventful week in May, Beau Akins buried his beloved dog Jasper, who had been his best friend for 9 years, unloaded his house in Beverly Hills, purchased at the peak of the market, sold in a trough, delivered the final draft of a screenplay he'd described in early pitch meetings as a cross between Patch Adams and Aliens, in which sentimental treacle was daringly blended with gut-wrenching extraterrestrial terror, divorced his avaricious wife, the suddenly hot actress Gwyneth Belmont, formerly known as Ginger Buttkiss, whom he suspected of poisoning Jasper, went to Cedars-Sinai Hospital to visit his agent Ethan, who'd been wounded in a drive-by shooting outside the main entrance to Paramount Studios, and later walked down the hall to console a fellow writer, Jamie Toplin, who had been shot in a curious episode on the Disney lot after a meeting to discuss his profit participation in Massacres and Melodies, the musical version of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which had been a blockbuster hit last year. On Tuesday, Beau sold his Porsche. On Wednesday, he shipped his belongings to storage. On Friday, he left Los Angeles in his Ford Explorer in search of a new life in a small town where people were real, where the pace was leisurely, where he might discover meaning in his existence, and where real estate prices wouldn't make him tremble with anxiety and spit up blood. At 30, after 8 years as a hugely successful screenwriter of action comedies, Beau was rich, even subsequent to an eviscerating divorce from the lovely Gwyneth. If he managed his finances well, he had many years in which to fulfill his dream of becoming a serious novelist, a goal he had reason to believe was within his talents. Years ago, he had won 2 literary prizes, and his short stories had been published in several prestigious literary magazines. Then, when he was 22, to fulfill a reckless boast made on a drunken evening with friends, he had written a screenplay, one of those buddy pictures about 2 mismatched cops. In this case, a cynical Los Angeles homicide detective is assigned, against his will, to work with a visiting Tokyo detective, who is also a 350-pound sumo wrestler and Zen master. Together they find the kidnapped daughter of a Japanese billionaire, though not before wrecking 6 cars, blowing up a yacht, driving a bus off the roof of a 6-story parking garage, careening through a shopping mall in a fire truck, chasing on horseback through a convent full of hysterical nuns, and knitting up the unraveled relationship between the LA cop and his estranged wife, who is pregnant with their first child. To win the bet, Beau had to write only a script strong enough to land an agent. He secured an agent, all right, and in 72 hours, the agent sold Sumo Cop to Universal for $2 million. Having been a committed bohemian and an academic geek throughout college, Beau had valued art and disdained commerce. He had been certain that money would never distract him from his calling as a novelist. He had been wrong. Remaining uncorrupted by the demon dollar was easy when your pockets were as empty as rain barrels in the Mojave, more difficult when cloudbursts of cash showered on you. The past 8 years had passed in a money green blur. On the drive north from Los Angeles, he worried that being churned through the Hollywood machine had left him a few thousand brain cells short of the number needed to write novels. By the time he had passed Santa Barbara, however, the tinsel years fell into a twilight of memory as a dream fades and the future looked bright. Santa Maria, San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles. He drove all the way to Carmel, where he stopped for the night, and Saturday morning he traveled north past San Francisco. The Golden Gate Bridge was wrapped in fog, the bay invisible below, but when he reached the North Shore, the mist folded back, and a sun-drenched landscape was revealed like a wondrous, shining gift. He had a long list of towns that he intended to inspect until he found the perfect place to settle down, meditate, and create. Napa, Sonoma, Ronert Park, Bodega Bay, Mendocino. 5 days after crossing the Golden Gate, on Thursday morning, he entered Black River, which nestled among wooded hills and rolling green fields. The streets were shaded by cedars, cypresses, and California live oaks. Much of the architecture was postcard quaint and authentic, largely Victorian, but with Russian Gothic structures mixed throughout, and even with some fine craftsman-style homes. In spite of its name, the river that slipped through the town was pure, fed by snow melt from the distant Sierras. Deep, flowing over a bed that was more rock than silt, shadowed by the hills, the water was clear and, where untouched by sunlight, black indeed. The only thorn in this rose was a sprawling, three-story, ultra-modern structure on the east edge of town, the headquarters of a company called Nextech. Beau didn't want to commit to this little corner of paradise if it were destined to become the capital of a new Silicon Valley. Then the quiet streets would be choked with traffic. Trendy bistros with pretentious food would spring up everywhere, and at dinner the only conversation to be heard at surrounding tables would be technobabble, which was the one thing more tedious than the film biz buzz that filled so many West Side restaurants in L.A. When Beau settled into a chair at the counter in Helen's Diner, which looked onto the town square, the lunchtime chatter around him concerned the cool weather, the good fishing this spring, upcoming quarter-horse races, and the qualities that differentiate a good dog from a great dog. Favored dress was boots, Levi's, flannel shirts, denim or nylon jackets. Not a pair of designer jeans in the place. The food wasn't pretentious either. Tasty country cooking, solid enough to be used as building materials. Regardless of what they were having for their main courses, most of the patrons also piled on generous side orders of batter-fried bacon or home fries. Mouth-watering fragrances laced the air, and Beau figured that just breathing would raise his cholesterol level by 10 points. The carrot juice and diet carob custard crowd in West L.A. would react to this scene with moral outrage, horror. Yet here Beau saw more people simply, deeply enjoying food than he'd seen in the past 8 years combined, and possibly in part because of this guiltless pleasure, these locals were by all appearances appealingly mellow. As he reacquainted himself with the glories of butter and whole eggs and fried ham, Beau read the real estate classifieds in the Black River Gazette, astonished to see that not one listed dwelling would require the buyer to become a part-time hitman to meet the mortgage payments. While bantering with regular customers and providing superb service, the waitress, a fresh-faced brunette named Mandy, cheerfully advised Beau on the desirability of the locations of some of the houses that most intrigued him. Near the end of lunch, as Beau began to think he had found his future in Black River, three men got up from a booth toward the back of the diner, and while two went to the door, the third approached the counter. "Mister, I'll add friendly advice to Mandy's, if I may." No tanner's vat had ever produced finer leather than the sun had made of this man's skin. The mane of white hair, the white mustache, the merry blue eyes, and the toymaker's smile reminded Beau of Geppetto in Pinocchio. Although when Beau turned on his stool with a smile of his own, he was not met with sweet counsel, but with bile. The merry eyes turned bitter, and the smile tightened into a snarl. "The last thing this town needs is more of you slick Los Angeles types looking for the simple life, but then too superior to fit in. Always trying to make us just like you, mocking our values, laughing at our beliefs, driving up real estate prices so our kids and our grandkids can't even afford to live in their own hometown anymore." Beau wanted to explain that he wasn't like those other Angelinos, those smartly dressed and expensively coiffed Huns in Mercedes and Porsches. Their breath rank with cappuccino, but every time he tried to speak, he was talked down by Geppetto. The friendly advice escalated into a tirade. As Beau's face reddened and as a gruel of embarrassment and anger clogged his throat, he was less affected by Geppetto's rant than by the silence of everyone else in the diner. Perhaps this geezer, bigger than he had first appeared, robust in spite of his age, was the town crank, and perhaps he was even dangerous, which might explain why the other customers either kept their heads bowed over their food or watched stone-faced. Nevertheless, Beau couldn't shake the suspicion that they were silent because they agreed with the old man. In light of his adversary's age and unprovoked belligerence, Beau decided to respond with silence. Having seen a few unpleasant reviews of his screenplays over the years, he had learned to take criticism with stoic resolve. Responding to a film reviewer would only invite a second assault more vicious than the first. Opting for discretion, he treated Geppetto as he would a critic. By the time the codger finished venting and stalked out of the diner, Beau was red-faced with humiliation more than with anger. His heart pounded. Blood sang in his ears. Although he was aware that Mandy, the waitress, was talking to him, he didn't hear what she was saying. She appeared to be rattled by the episode, and she seemed sweet-natured and kind, so it might have been an accident when she knocked over a glass, sending a cascade of ice water into Beau's lap. But then one of the other patrons laughed, and even though it was just a single person laughing, and though the laugh sounded more nervous than gleeful, Beau found himself reacting to the spill as if it were unquestionably a continuation of the assault begun by the old man. The smothered rage that lays beneath the surface mellowness of many Angelenos, revealed most often in freeway altercations, had not been left behind in the City of Angels. Spitting out a series of colorful expletives, he spun his stool away from the lunch counter, shot to his feet, grabbed a wad of paper napkins from a dispenser, blotted his pants, threw the napkins on the floor, and left Helen's Diner without paying. At the door, he saw a video camera aimed down at him, part of a security system. He raised his middle finger to it, which he knew was childish even as he did it. Anger, like fear, sometimes reduces us to adolescence. Outside, he realized that the Black River Gazette, folded open to the real estate classifieds, was still clutched in his left hand. He threw it into a nearby trash receptacle on which was stenciled, "Keep Black River Beautiful," and he figured the best thing he could do to beautify the town would be to find that ranting old fool from the diner, fold him like a used newspaper, and shove him into a garbage can. In his Explorer, as Beau sought the road out of town, his anger subsided. In fact, he began to feel a bit ashamed of his outburst, to which the waitress certainly hadn't deserved to be exposed if, as seemed more likely with each passing block, she had knocked over the water glass sheerly by accident. The old man's tirade hadn't been accidental, however, and the silence of the other patrons still seemed conspiratorial. No matter what the nature of Mandy's sympathies and intentions, Black River was now spoiled for Beau. Taking long, deep breaths, he mentally recited the names of the picturesque towns ahead of him on his search for a new home, repeated them over and over in his mind as a monk might finger worry beads. Block by block, he grew calmer. He couldn't have been more than 2 minutes from the town limits when he noticed that he was being followed by a police cruiser. The array of beacons on its roof began to flash and rotate. He wasn't speeding. He had not run any stop signs. For a moment he was certain that he couldn't be the object of the cop's attention, that the patrol car would turn left or right and speed away from him at the next intersection. His certainty was shattered by a short burst of the siren. He drove to the curb and parked. The cruiser stopped behind him, beacons still flashing, but the policeman didn't immediately get out. Beau could see him back there, holding a radio handset, talking to someone. Maybe they would arrest him for failing to pay for lunch. Was that possible? Jail time over a bacon and cheeseburger, coleslaw and fries, which he hadn't even finished? He was so focused on the rearview mirror, watching the officer in the car behind him, that he didn't immediately see another black and white approaching from in front of him. A bark of brakes alerted Bo, and he glanced away from the mirror in time to see the second Black River Police Department cruiser come to a sudden stop 3 feet away, nose to nose with his explorer. The officer behind the wheel was talking on his radio, too, no doubt coordinating with the policeman in the first car. They had effectively boxed him, as though they thought he might make a run for it. Maybe failure to pay for the cheeseburger was only part of the problem. He had also raised his middle finger to the security camera in the diner. And after being soaked with the ice water, he had spoken a few words that were intemperate. Some of these small towns were just old-fashioned enough to have statutes against using obscene language in public places. While such a case against him would eventually be thrown out of court on First Amendment grounds, he might be subjected to considerable inconvenience in the short run. Even a couple of small-town cops, however, would have to realize that his outburst in the diner had been provoked, that old Geppetto had verbally assaulted Bo, not the other way around, unless all the patrons conspired to lie about what had happened. That was paranoid. On the other hand, was it unlikely that a bunch of locals, angry at outsiders for taking over their town, might hang together to teach a lesson to a foul-mouthed Angelino? Bo glanced down at his chinos, which were still wet from the ice water. The stain was the only proof that his version of events was the truth, but in an hour this fragile evidence would have vanished. Ridiculous, he chided himself. He was already too defensive. He had done nothing wrong. Nothing seriously wrong, anyway. He withdrew his wallet from his hip pocket and fished out his driver's license. He lowered his window, preparing to be a good and cooperative citizen. As if synchronized, the policemen got out of their cars and studied him, not yet approaching. He could see one of them through the windshield, the other in his side mirror. Each man stood with his right hand on the grip of his holstered weapon, which seemed unnecessarily menacing under the circumstances. Cheeseburger, coleslaw, fries, a little cursing. Nothing that should suggest to them a danger of gunplay. Maybe this stance, hand on gun upon exiting cruiser, was just standard procedure. Bo smiled. Smile couldn't hurt. Slowly they approached the explorer. As nervous tremors fluttered through his belly, Bo decided that he would pay for his lunch, leave a fat tip for Mandy, make effusive apologies all around, even to Geppetto if necessary, and put an end to this as quickly as possible. He felt gutless, but he could live with that. One of the cops stopped 10 feet from the explorer. The other came to the open window. He asked for the vehicle registration and a driver's license. Still smiling, Bo provided both items and then asked, "What's this about, officer?" Instead of answering him, the cop said, "You're Borden Akins?" "Yes, sir." "People call me Bo," he said inanely, half wondering how all his Hollywood cool could have deserted him so quickly. The officer's eyes were gray. Cold and steely. Very effective. Intimidating. If he'd been a Beverly Hills cop, you'd have suspected that he was wearing tinted contact lenses. "You don't much resemble this photo." He tapped the license. "I shaved off the mustache a few weeks ago." "Hair's different." "Yes, sir." "New cut." "Latest look," Bo said, and immediately felt foppish, shallow, and stupid. The cop studied him for a moment and then said, "Would you please get out of the car, sir?" With a smile that was fixed as hard as a frozen turkey, Bo opened the door and got out of the explorer. "Please face the vehicle with your hands flat on it," the cop said, and he maintained his grip on his holstered weapon. Now, as bewildered as he was fearful, Beau complied. The cop patted him down for a weapon, then handcuffed him. "Am I being arrested?" Beau asked, dismayed to hear a tremor in his voice. "At this point, sir, we're just taking you into custody for questioning until we can clarify this situation." He recited a short list of suspects' rights. "I'll pay for the burger," Beau said. "Burger, sir?" "And I had a Diet Pepsi. Drank most of it. Not all of it, but most. And the waitress deserves a tip, too."
"I'm not following you, sir."
"It was childish to give the finger to the security camera. I was just pissed, but that's no excuse."
After a moment of puzzled silence, the cop said, "Sir, you do not seem entirely coherent to me, so I am going to ask this other officer to inspect your vehicle for controlled substances."
"Drugs? I don't do drugs." "I hate drugs," Beau said, and though he was sincere, he knew he sounded suspicious.
As the first officer walked Beau toward the nearest cruiser, the second man began to search the Explorer. Having written a few screenplays in which corrupt police played at least minor roles, Beau was alarmed by the thought that these guys would plant enough pot or coke to charge him with felony possession. He was smart enough to know life rarely, if ever, resembled movies, but he worried nonetheless. As Beau was about to be put into the back of the patrol car, his fear had grown so great that he was finally motivated to challenge the cop by demanding to know why he had been pulled over.
"That vehicle's on a hot sheet," the officer said.
"What?"
"Stolen."
"No."
"No. Stolen? No, it's my Explorer."
"That's what we've got to check out. But one thing's for sure. You're the bad luck boy of the day."
"Huh?" "That license plate number and vehicle description came up on our car computer maybe half a minute before you drove past us."
Locked in the back seat of the black and white, watching through a wire security screen while the first cop rejoined the second at the Explorer, Beau was victimized by his aggressive imagination. In his mind's eye, he saw a town jail as squalid as a prison in the worst of third-world hellholes. Filthy, reeking, crawling with cockroaches. A claustrophobia-inducing pen that he would no doubt have to share with a hulking homicidal maniac who would ask him to dance. The lunch crowd thinned out. Helen's diner became quiet. While she filled salt and pepper shakers, Mandy Petrell couldn't stop thinking about the guy on whom she'd spilled the water. Beau. She'd never before known anyone named Beau. She'd never known a movie writer before, either. He'd been pleasant, soft-spoken, sort of cute. Frank Yarny, who had embarrassed Beau and everyone in the diner, was a hateful crank who had just two moods— sullen silence and loud complaint. He was sour in the best of times, a pain in the butt when he was in full rant, and downright scary when he was drunk. Mandy wished she could have explained about Frank before she'd knocked over the water glass. Poor Beau was just looking for a place to call home, after having felt like an outsider during his years in Los Angeles. He would probably have been as good for Black River as the town would have been for him. No doubt he was gone for good, however, after the scene with Frank. Beau said he'd never had roots, but now felt a deep need for them. Mandy understood about roots. As an orphan who hadn't been eminently adoptable because of childhood medical problems, long since resolved, thank God, she had been raised in a series of foster homes from the age of two. She'd felt adrift most of her life, and she had always longed for family, stability, roots. 2 years ago, shortly after her 24th birthday, she had learned she was not an only child, as she'd long thought, but was the youngest of two girls. Her sister, a year older than Mandy, had been placed for adoption. Now, presumably, the sister was out there to be found. Family.
In spite of 2 years of searching, using an array of social services, Mandy hadn't been able to track down her sister, at first because the adoption agency records were sealed. When she'd gained access after a series of legal procedures, she had discovered that the records were in disarray. Dead end. Now, as she filled the final shaker, she spilled a little salt on the counter. She wasn't a superstitious person, but suddenly she was sure this was a sign that she would never find her sister, and she quickly threw a pinch of the salt over her shoulder to cancel the bad mojo. The town jail was clean and pleasant. Beau's cell had a barred window with a lovely view of a park, and he didn't have to share the space with an axe murderer in a romantic mood. The chief of police, Walter Salk, was a well-padded 50-year-old with an ageless and cherubic face. His manner was so folksy that he offered Beau a choice of coffee, tea, or Pepsi, and brought the tea to the cell himself. Nevertheless, Beau had no desire to buy monogrammed towels, hang curtains, and settle down here. He had not demanded to speak to a lawyer because his attorney was in Los Angeles, and it would take a couple hours to get a quality referral in this area. He remained hopeful that this mess would be cleared up even before an attorney could be retained. After all, the Explorer was his. And contrary to his worst expectations, the police had not claimed to have found illegal drugs in his possession. Indeed, after Beau spent more than 2 hours in the cell, Chief Salk let him out, led him to the reception area, returned his wallet, apologized with what seemed to be genuine regret, and explained that the appearance of his license plate number and vehicle description on a hot sheet bulletin had been a computer error. Bewildered, unable to recall either having been offered more tea or having accepted it, Beau stood with a second cup of the brew cooling in his hand, untasted, while he listened to Salk's apology. But computer error. How could it be a computer error? We don't know. Don't understand it. Our computer system here is linked to a national law enforcement web. Data comes from a lot of agencies. This bulletin, it was supposed to have originated with the California Highway Patrol, but ours seems to be the only police department that received it. And no one at the CHP will fess up to having sent it out. Beau cocked his head quizzically. Was that an explanation? No, sir, it surely wasn't. Some kind of bureaucratic screw-up is the best I can tell you. A bureaucratic blunder. Putting out a hot sheet item on my car, just seconds before I drove past one of your cruisers? Beau asked disbelievingly. I feel really bad about this, I surely do, said Salk, and his smooth, round, cherubic face appeared to be incapable of deceit. Perhaps some would have started talking about a lawsuit by this point. Salk had a wary look in his eyes, as if he expected to hear those dreaded words. Although Beau was angry at having been unjustly detained and suspicious about the circumstances behind his arrest, the only thing he wanted was to dust Black River off his shoes and get on with his life. Suppressing his anger, voice colored only by weariness, Beau accepted his 2 suitcases, which a deputy removed from an evidence locker, and said, "I'll need the keys to my Explorer." Chief Salk looked relieved. I'll take you out back to the department garage. That's where it's parked. But first, from a drawer of his desk, he extracted a decal, an official-looking seal that proclaimed Honorary Deputy American Association of Chiefs of Police. I'm grateful for your understanding, Mr. Akins. I want to personally put this useful item on your bumper. Behind the station house was a small parking lot and an alleyway. Across the alley lay the department garage, where a mechanic was working on a disabled patrol car. The Explorer wasn't there.
according to the mechanic, a towing company, having received an official CHP faxed notice to collect and transport the Explorer at once, had hauled it off to a public auction yard, where it was to be sold with other vehicles seized under the asset forfeiture laws. The mechanic had a copy of the order, which looked real enough, and which listed Beau Akins as a felon convicted of possession of heroin for the purpose of sale, and citing the Explorer as a vehicle used in the commission of a major crime, and therefore fair game for forfeiture. Chief Salk was speechless. Beau wasn't.
"What the hell is going on here?"
"We'll straighten this out."
"I want my Explorer."
"You'll get it," Salk promised, "and someone's head will roll." Clutching the honorary deputy decal, Salk led Beau back to the station house. He didn't appear cherubic anymore. In his uniform and Smokey the Bear hat, he looked like a plump, angry Boy Scout. Within minutes, Salk was able to ascertain that the vehicle had been taken to an auction yard halfway across the county, that the yard had just closed for the day, and that the Explorer couldn't be retrieved until 8 o'clock the next morning. No one could explain how the erroneous towing order had been issued or who was behind it. Salk, who appeared to be flirting with cardiac infarction, said, "The city will pay for your motel room tonight, dinner and breakfast, and whatever seems appropriate compensation for your time. There'll be no argument about that, no sir. No argument from any damn one." Holding another cup of untasted tea, Beau nodded dumbly. Strangely, anger was no longer his overwhelming emotion. He was at least half convinced that Salk and the deputies were innocent in all of this, and that they were no less bewildered than Beau himself. His anger subsided because he could see no obvious or easy target for it, and he was overcome instead by quiet dread. Quiet, but growing deeper and darker by the minute. He didn't know what he dreaded, but the formlessness of his enemy didn't make it any less formidable. After working the breakfast and lunch shift at the diner, Mandy stopped at Vaughn's to shop for groceries. She didn't get back to her apartment until 5 o'clock, and she was putting away the last of the frozen foods when the telephone rang.
"Mandy Pottrell?" the caller asked.
It was a woman, and she sounded strange. Shaky, maybe a little bewildered, also a little scared.
"Speaking," Mandy said. You don't know me, but..."
"Yes?"
"My name's Laura Crosby. I'm calling from Boston."
"Boston?" Mandy was so little traveled that to her, Boston seemed as exotic as Singapore.
I understand you were orphaned when you were 2.
Frowning, Mandy said,
"Yeah, 2.
"And you have a sister you haven't seen since then?"
"I'm looking for her," Mandy said, and her heart began to race.
"I work in a bank," Laura Crosby said, suddenly talking fast, words running together, "and this afternoon I got some anonymous email, someone telling me that I was adopted, that my real last name isn't Crosby. I have a younger sister, and she works at Helen's Diner in Black River, and this is her home phone number. I never knew I was adopted. My folks, my mom and dad, we've had a pretty emotional get-together this evening, and it's true, I am adopted. And Mom says there was a little sister, a sickly little sister. They didn't remember her name, but my original name, my born name, is Laura Pottrell." Mandy couldn't speak. For a moment, neither could Laura. Then,
"Could you be? Could you? My sister?"
"Oh, God," Mandy said. She started to cry, and so did Laura, far away in Boston. The motel was clean and comfortable, but not luxurious. Black River didn't offer any 4- or 5-star accommodations.
Beau wouldn't have felt any better if he'd been occupying the presidential suite in a luxury resort hotel. He was weighed down by and unable to shake a sense of doom. He told himself that he was letting his imagination get the better of him, which was an occupational hazard for a writer. By nature, a writer looked for stories in the events of his day, often finding meaningful patterns and potentially horrendous consequences where other people saw nothing of the sort. Most of the time he was wrong, melodramatic, even flat-out paranoid. But not always. Now he decided that it would be wise to let a few friends know where he was and what had happened, in case... well, just... in case. Consulting his compact electronic address book, he phoned his screenwriter friend, Jamie Toplin, in Westwood. Jamie would by now be out of the hospital and recuperating from his gunshot wound. A recording informed Beau that Jamie's number was no longer in service. Surprised, he resorted to the information operator, but she had no new listing. He called Ethan, his agent, at home. The phone rang 30 times before Beau hung up. This made no sense. At least he should have gotten an answering machine, because Ethan, like all agents, was loath to miss a single call at any hour of the day or night. When he tried Ethan's office number, it didn't ring. After listening to a dead line for half a minute, he hung up and keyed in the number again. He got a pizza parlor in L.A. On the third try, though he carefully entered each digit, he was connected to a convenience store where the clerk spoke with a heavy Korean accent. He phoned another friend in West Hollywood. A recording claimed that service to this prefix was temporarily interrupted and that repairs would be completed soon. Dismayed to see his hands trembling, he phoned the Bel Air number of a producer who had turned two of his scripts into highly profitable films. He got the pizza parlor again. In desperation, he called his mother and father in Klamath Falls, Oregon, but he was connected to a 900 number, a phone sex operation that welcomed him with a recorded smorgasbord of the names of 10 hot nymphettes with whom he could talk dirty for $2 a minute. He was not going to be permitted to speak with anyone who knew him in the world beyond Black River. For a while he sat staring at the phone, wondering how the hell such control had been exerted, and by whom, and why. Eventually he left his room only to walk to the bank of vending machines near the motel office. He certainly couldn't return to Helen's diner for dinner. In fact, going anywhere at night in this town seemed as dangerous as taking a stroll in a South American jungle full of panthers, snakes, and spiders the size of bowling balls. He bought 2 packs of cheese crackers, a bag of peanuts, 2 candy bars, and 2 cans of root beer. In his room again, he turned on the television. Within 5 minutes, he turned it off because he kept imagining that the TV was masking the sound of someone stealthily trying the locked door. He sat up in bed to eat dinner, and this junk food binge made him feel 14 again. At 14, however, he'd been happy and carefree, much happier and more carefree than he'd realized at the time. Now the crackers and peanuts and candy were cloying, even tasteless, and he couldn't finish them. The phone rang. He stared at it until it had rung 6 times, and at last he picked it up. "Hello?" The man's voice, firm but not angry, wasn't one that Beau recognized. "You should not have been mean to Mandy." The waitress. "Who is this?" Beau asked. "I like Mandy. Everyone likes Mandy. She's nice. She's a good citizen." The caller hung up. Beau listened to the silent line for a moment. Then he went to the door and wedged a straight-backed chair under the knob because he didn't trust in just the deadbolt and security chain. Mandy and Laura talked for 2 hours, astonished by how similar they were in many ways, and near the end of the conversation, Laura decided she would take a week of accumulated vacation and come to Black River to visit.
"We have so much catching up to do."
Swiveling on the kitchen stool, looking around her humble studio apartment, Mandy's face flushed as she said,
"Oh, gee, I don't even have an extra bed. I'll get a motel room."
"I don't live very fancy. I don't..."
"Sis," Laura said, "I don't care what your furniture's like.
Most of it came with the apartment,
or what kind of car you drive."
"An old blue Chevy pickup. I love that truck."
"I just care about you. I want to see your face."
That made Mandy cry again. She'd cried a lot during the past 2 hours. So had Laura, who was also crying again.
"And Black River's not like Boston," Mandy warned between tears. "No museums or art galleries or nightclubs full of clever people."
"I don't need to be entertained," Laura said. "Just being together is enough."
Beau figured he would be wide awake all night. For one thing, he couldn't bring himself to turn off all the lights. The room was too bright to encourage sleep. Besides every slightest noise, the cough of a guest in another room, traffic passing on the highway, alarmed him. He was lying in bed fully dressed atop the covers. He was even wearing his shoes. He was ready to move quickly if necessary. His mind was overheating as he concocted movie plots from the events of the day. He spun half a dozen storylines, but in every case he failed to come up with a third act. He couldn't figure out how to explain what was happening to his beleaguered hero. What he needed was a buddy to help him puzzle it out. Maybe a sumo wrestler and crack detective from Tokyo. Near midnight, the phone rang. Beau sat up in bed to answer it. The caller was the same soft-spoken man who had rung before. Black River needs an arts community if it's to be an ideal town.
"What do you want from me?"
"Poets, musicians, painters, sculptors.
Creative energy.
You're a writer. You could be the start of that."
"What are you talking about?"
"This could be a new Athens. Think about it." Click. Beau put down the phone. After a minute, he stretched out on the bed again, staring at the ceiling.
Athens.
Frank Yarny wasn't a young man anymore, wasn't as strong as in his youth, but when he was drunk, he was so mean that men half his age would not mess with him, no matter how obnoxious he became. Local cops didn't have the nerve to stop him when he was clearly driving under the influence. And when they came upon him on foot, even pit bulls had been known to cross the street to avoid Frank. By midnight, he was unquestionably the drunkest man in the Lone Star Roadhouse. He'd come in for a steak at dinner time, but he had put down more beer than beef. He'd told everyone in the place about how he'd reamed out that candy-ass bastard from L.A. over at Helen's Diner earlier in the day. In fact, he'd told most of them about it twice or three times, and he'd tell them again if he felt like it. They would listen to it as often as he wanted to tell about it, all of them grinning like they'd never heard it before, because when Frank Yarny talked, by God, people better listen. At the moment, he was more interested in dancing than talking. A gal named Regine had caught his eye, and he was going to do some two-step romancing. She was 25 years younger than Frank, and she was with a date, but details of that kind never fazed him. He put a dollar bill in the new-fangled jukebox. The machine blazed with colored lights, as you'd expect, but instead of a rotating selection menu, there was a computer screen. The juke sucked up the dollar bill, and on the screen came the words, "Make two selections, partner." half a buck a song. He remembered when you got a tune for a nickel. Robbery, he muttered. In truth, the new juke fascinated him because it had an infinite selection, virtually any country-western song ever recorded. It was linked to the Internet, or to a satellite, or to a damn big spaceship between here and the moon. Some damn thing like that, where this huge library of music was stored, and the song was sent off by radar or some such, and then through a phone line here to the juke. When you thought about that, half a buck seemed to be a bargain. Using the touch-sensitive keyboard printed on the screen, he typed Alan Jackson. The computer corrected the spelling, deleting one L from the first name. Smart ass, Frank said. As the song title, he entered Rock That Jukebox, and the computer immediately corrected it to Don't Rock the Jukebox. He was tempted to pick up a chair and smash the machine, but then he wouldn't have any two-step music to which he could shove Regine around the floor. He instructed the juke to play the song twice, and it said, "Downloading from the big honky-tonk in the sky, partner." Frank was so drunk he had to read the words slowly, speaking them aloud to puzzle out their meaning. Then those words vanished, and the blue outline of a hand appeared on the screen. Above the outline was an instruction, "Place your hand here for bonus prize, cowboy." When Frank placed his big hand flat on the screen, new words appeared. Rude, aggressive, violent drunks contribute nothing to civilization. Frank got as far as nothing, slowly reading the words aloud, when a tremendous charge of electricity phased through the screen, jolted into his body, and flung him 20 feet. Women screamed and men shouted in alarm as Frank crashed into a pair of empty chairs. In a tumble of furniture, he landed on his back at the edge of the dance floor. After the first cries of shock, as customers came to their feet, the roadhouse fell silent. At first, no one approached Frank Yarny, perhaps because his clothes were smoking and his singed hair was crackling with a residue of electricity. Or perhaps because no one was eager to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation if he were still alive. At last, the bartender sidled to the body, took a closer look, winced, and turned away. Alan Jackson began to sing Don't Rock the Jukebox, a terrific country swing number, but nobody was in the mood to boogie. At least not until the coroner hauled the corpse off the dance floor. Bo Akins slept fitfully, which was better than he had expected to sleep, and shortly after first light he rose, showered, shaved, and changed into fresh clothes. For breakfast he washed down cheese crackers with root beer. Chief Salk had promised to call shortly after 8 o'clock to confirm that the explorer had been picked up at the auction yard at the other end of the county and would be returned to Black River well before noon. When Salk hadn't called by 8:30, Bo took the initiative and rang the police station. "It's not so easy as it looked," Salk said nervously. "I feel plain awful about this. But it seems like when the tow truck driver got to the auction yard yesterday, there was a CHP directive waiting for him. Came in on the yard's fax, and he had to haul your vehicle somewhere else. He didn't actually leave it there."
"CHP?
Highway Patrol, again?" "Yes, sir. But the CHP can't explain how that order initiated any more than they can explain the one that got your vehicle hauled to the auction yard in the first place. I hope... Well, you do understand, Mr. Akins, that my department's almost as big a victim in this as you are." Yesterday, Bo's anger had been supplanted by a strange sense of doom. Now he was angry again, and the anger felt good. Clenching the telephone handset so tightly that his knuckles ached, he said, Where's my explorer?
Well, we don't know for sure yet. The folks at the auction yard don't remember the details of that second directive, so we're trying to get in touch with the tow truck driver here in Black River. Minute that happens, I'll get back to you, Mr. Akins.
When?
Soon. Bo paced for 15 minutes, snatched up the phone on the first ring, and said, "What?" Chief Salk was in a better mood, almost bubbly. "Just spoke to Lee Hooten, the tow truck driver. Where he finally left your explorer yesterday was at a salvage yard all the way down to Santa Rosa."
"Salvage yard?"
"We're getting in touch with them right now."
"Why would it be sent to a salvage yard?"
"Why any of this?" Salk wondered. "But at least we're on the track of it now. I'll call you in a few minutes."
Bo switched on the television and sat staring at Good Morning America without registering who was interviewing whom or a word of what they said. When Chief Salk called again, his high-flying mood had crashed. Before this was over, he was going to wind up a manic depressive.
"Mr. Akins, sir, this is... well, I'm at a loss. There's no way to come at this easy, so I'll just tell you flat out. This morning, per a CHP order, the folks at that salvage yard over to Santa Rosa, they stripped the tires off your explorer, took out the seats and some other upholstery, and then compacted the vehicle."
Bo sat on the edge of the bed.
"Compacted?"
"In a crusher. You know those big hydraulic rams that squash a whole car into a 3-foot cube?"
"They crushed my explorer?"
"Yes, sir, they did. About 20 minutes ago." "But it's only a year old. It was in beautiful shape."
"They thought it was odd themselves to compact a real nice SUV like that."
Through clenched teeth, Bo said, "So why did they crush it?"
"Well, they had that CHP directive,
which no one at the CHP can explain." After a hesitation, Chief Salk said, "Mr. Akins, what I think we better do first thing this morning, as soon as it can be arranged, is have you sit down with the city attorney, me, and the mayor, to see how this can be worked out."
"I know how it can be worked out," Bo said. "I'll sue your ass off, that's how."
"Well, I'm sure we can avoid that, make you happy. We're all victims here, Mr. Akins. The city of Black River as much as you."
"It's my explorer that's been squashed."
"What I need you to do, Mr. Akins, is just sit tight for maybe half an hour until I can line up all the principles. I assure you this can be settled to your satisfaction. I'll call you back in 30 minutes, maybe sooner."
"All right."
"Good. Thank you, sir. Very good."
Bo put down the phone, left his room, went to the motel office, and asked the desk clerk where he could find a car rental agency. The only car rental agency in town was a national franchise operated as a sideline by the local Ford dealership. The clerk, a wholesome-looking young woman named Franny, was friendly and quick to smile. As she went over the selection of available vehicles and filled out the paperwork, she was full of folksy chatter about the weather and the upcoming May Festival, which seemed to be the biggest event of the year in Black River. Bo had grown suspicious of small-town folksiness, easy smiles, friendly strangers. His suspicion proved well-placed when Franny returned his American Express card with the news that it had been rejected both by the verification machine and by the American Express operator. "Account canceled," she said, her smile now strained.
"Impossible," Bo said, his heart beginning to hammer too hard as if he'd been sprinting.
"Run it again."
She ran the card again, but with the same result.
He gave her his Visa card. That, too, was rejected. His MasterCard wasn't accepted either. Bo had the crazy feeling that he was going to fade completely out of existence. In the modern world, the loss of credit was the first step toward becoming a non-person. Next, his credit cards would actually vanish, as if he'd never been worthy of them. Then the photo on his driver's license. Then the license itself. Soon people would start to look through him as if he were not real. When he spoke, they'd cock their heads and look puzzled, as though they had heard a distant cry, but couldn't place the source. "This is crap," he thundered. A man in an adjoining office glanced up from his desk, frowning, and Franny looked as if she might call the cops. That was the last thing Bo needed. The sight of chubby Chief Walter Salk might reduce him to incoherent rage, to such a display of spitting and fuming and wordless snarling that they would either consign him to a psychiatric ward or to a dog pound. Stuffing the useless plastic back in his wallet, he said, "Does this town have a taxi company?" Wide-eyed and fearful, as if confronted by a modern Dillinger, Franny nodded.
"Yes?"
"Will you call them for me?" Trying to calm himself, he smiled, realizing at once that his smile had become a twisted, fearsome thing. She keyed in the number of the taxi company and handed the phone to him. Although he had seen Franny enter only the 7 digits of a local number, the call was answered by the pizza parlor in distant Los Angeles, to which he had been incorrectly connected 2x the previous night. He hung up without ordering, left the rental agency, and walked into the heart of town. The sky was blue and cloudless. The leaves of the plane trees and oaks trembled delicately in a faint warm breeze. The Victorian houses were especially lovely in the morning sun, which highlighted the elaborate millwork. The sunshine, the warm breeze, the beauty of Black River, all of it repulsed him. Because it was a lie, deception, a layer of pancake makeup and mascara concealing darker truths. He was being melodramatic again. He didn't care. His simmering fury at the deceptively charming surface of this time and place was laced with irony. After all, he'd spent the past 8 years creating and selling glittering deceits. Movies were, for the most part, lies, because they taught audiences that violence was as beautiful as ballet, that sex had no consequences, that doing the right thing was obvious and easy, but also that virtue was the bread of fools, that emotion was superior to reason. Having for so long embraced and profited from deceit, perhaps he should have forfeited his right to be outraged by it. He was outraged, nonetheless. The problem was, he didn't know at whom he should be outraged. The person or persons behind these recent bizarre events were no less well concealed than God. As he passed a payphone outside a pharmacy, it began to ring. He halted, staring at the fiendish instrument, irrationally convinced that the call was for him. He was flirting with the ultimate paranoid delusion. Solipsism, the conviction that only he himself was real, that all else in the world was false, that all other people and things were merely puppets and stage props used by mysterious, godlike conspirators to deceive and manipulate him. Fearful of surrendering to this solipsistic fantasy and never finding his way back to reason, Bo resisted the urge to pick up the ringing phone. He walked deeper into the heart of town. 2 blocks later, as he passed a public phone in front of a newsstand, it began to ring. This time he slowed but did not stop. He resisted the urge to run. The ringing continued behind him until he turned the corner at the end of the block. A bank of 3 phones stood in front of the post office. All shrilled at once as he approached them. An elderly man entering the post office seemed not to notice the chorus of electronic bells. Maybe he was deaf. Bo looked around, hoping someone would react to the oddity of all the ringing, but no one other than the senior citizen was nearby. With a desperate need to prove to himself that the ringing phones were a coincidence, he rushed to the center of the 3 and snatched up the handset. The flanking phones instantly fell silent.
"Good morning, Mr. Akins," said the soft-voiced man who had called the motel room the previous night.
"Who are you?"
"Call me Pericles."
"Is that a first or last name?"
"In my opinion, he was the statesman most responsible for the full flowering of Athens." "Do you agree?"
"What is this Athens business?"
"Black River can be the shining city on a hill, the example to all, a fountainhead of art and philosophy, a beacon of prosperity and amity and hope."
"It sure seems that way to me," Bo said sarcastically.
"Unfortunately, the altercation in Helen's diner gave you a negative impression of our town."
"Yeah. Otherwise, everything has been swell."
"Frank Yarny will never bother you again."
"Who?"
"The lout who verbally assaulted you at the diner. He was an impediment to an ideal society. He's dead now." Bo looked around at the quiet street dappled with sunshine and leaf shadows. He wouldn't have been surprised to see under a tree the Mad Hatter, the White Rabbit, and Alice waiting for him at a tea table. In a soft, cadenced speech that was almost hypnotic, Pericles said, "Give Black River a second chance. Settle in just for a while. Stay long enough to write a novel. Put down creative roots, Bo, and you'll find this can be paradise. Black River is your destiny." "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul," said Bo, quoting William Ernest Henley, surprised that he was able to do so after 8 years in Hollywood.
"Of course you are," Pericles assured him. "And if you're a wise captain, you'll drop anchor here." Not sure if that had been merely advice or a threat, Bo hung up. He stood for a moment, staring heavenward. This was the first time in his life that a clear blue sky had appeared ominous to him. He felt watched. Shoulders hunched and head slightly bowed, as if in anticipation of a lightning bolt or swarm of locusts, he walked to the bus station next door to the post office. Only 6 long-distance buses a day exited the interstate to deposit or pick up passengers and freight. Consequently, the bus station was nothing but a small storefront with a single ticket window and a waiting area with 8 chairs. The only employee was a clerk, a stout, red-haired woman in a green and orange, poppy-patterned blouse. A pair of rhinestone-studded glasses, secured by a chain of faux pearls, hung from her neck and rested on her ample bosom. "Sorry, no buses today," she said. Indicating the list of arrivals and departures on the scheduling board, Bo said, "Supposed to be a bus for San Francisco and points south in 20 minutes.
"Big foul-up," she explained.
"Some reason. Black River was left off all the drivers' itineraries, so they've all been roaring right past on the interstate."
"How'd that happen?"
"Nobody knows. Started yesterday afternoon, and they still haven't straightened it out. Seems a simple thing to fix, doesn't it? But people do what the paperwork tells them, and the paperwork says no Black River."
"Be a bus tomorrow?" he asked.
"This mess can't go on forever."
Bo stared wistfully at the scheduling board and finally said, "If a bus does pull in tomorrow, it'll probably blow up before it can leave."
The clerk plucked the dangling glasses off her bosom and put them on to take a better look at him.
"Don't worry," he said, smiling thinly. "I'm not a terrorist. Just clairvoyant."
Outside, the sky remained mercilessly clear, piercingly blue, like a great eye.
"I am the master of my fate," Beau muttered, and he set off along Main Street, heading for the town limits and the highway beyond. His suitcases were at the motel, but he could send someone for them later, or mail a check to have them shipped to him. Every time a vehicle approached, heading out of town, he stepped off the curb and raised a thumb. He hadn't hitchhiked since college. At his age, bumming a ride felt demeaning, but he swallowed his pride as if it were a cream puff.
The breakfast shift was busier than usual, so Mandy Patrell wasn't immediately able to tell Gina and Kelly, the other waitresses, about finding her long-lost sister. She was aglow with the unshared good news, however, and a few customers remarked on how pretty she looked this morning, which wasn't a compliment she often received. Just as the early rush was beginning to subside, Catherine Horn breezed into the diner and sat in one of the smaller booths. She was the town librarian, an outgoing and sweet-tempered woman of about 50, who reminded Mandy of all those pretty, charming, wise, and simply but impeccably dressed mothers in the sitcoms of the 1950s. A mom of the kind Mandy had yearned for as a child. From appearances, you wouldn't have guessed that tragedy lay at the heart of Catherine's life. After 4 years, her marriage had ended in a bitter divorce, and a year after that, her ex-husband had kidnapped their 3-year-old son, Joseph, and disappeared with him. Catherine hadn't seen her boy for 25 years, and she expected to die without seeing him again. In spite of the pain that life brought sooner or later to each of us, she believed we were obliged to recognize the tremendous beauty of this world, everywhere around us. God made the heavens and the earth to give us wonder and joy, she said, and any suffering that came our way was only a reminder that the rest of life was sweet and glorious. Mandy had not always been able to live by Catherine's wisdom, sometimes giving in to depression. She didn't know if Catherine had always managed to live by it either, but she admired the librarian and often turned to her for advice. And now, having found her sister Laura out there in distant Boston, Mandy felt such relief from her own worst pain, from her chronic loneliness, that she saw greater wisdom than ever in Catherine's philosophy. Mandy was bursting with her news, but before she could share it with Catherine, the librarian tugged on her arm, encouraging her to sit down in the booth. "Honey, you'll never guess what's happened to me. Such an amazing thing." "Me too." Catherine was too caught up in her own news to react to Mandy's interjection. "I was working late last night, budgeting third and fourth quarter book purchases, when the phone rang at the main desk. The library was closed for the night, but for some reason I answered it anyway, and this man, this complete stranger, who never did give me his name, he tells me that Joey, my boy, is alive and well and living in Denver, and then he gives me Joey's phone number." Mandy gasped. "Oh, my God. And, honey, it's true." She reached across the table and tightly grasped both of Mandy's hands. "I called Joey. I heard his voice. His father, my ex. He died last year. And he'd always told Joey that I'd died a long, long time ago. But now, my boy, he's coming straight here this weekend with his wife. Her name's Charlotte. And honey, they're bringing my granddaughter. She's 3. The same age as Joey when his father took him away. Her name is Rebecca Lynn. Little Rebecca Lynn." Catherine's eyes flooded with tears. Mandy's eyes were brimming too. A phone call from an anonymous stranger, Catherine said, and my whole life is made right again. Can you believe such a thing, dear? Can you believe it?
Yes, Mandy said. Yes, I can.
The guy said that his name was Harry Crunch and that he was a retired airline pilot, so many of his friends called him Captain or Captain Crunch, like the breakfast cereal. Captain Crunch was driving a Lincoln Navigator, arguably the plushest SUV on the road. This one boasted a custom candy apple red paint job, fancy stainless steel wheel rims that Beau figured cost at least $400 apiece, an upgrade concert hall quality sound system, a satellite-linked tracking system that provided a scrolling map on a dashboard computer screen with a locator light that showed the current position of the vehicle, and other amenities. To get out of Black River, Beau Akins would have accepted a ride in the back of a rattle-trap pickup truck beside a flea-bitten dog with bowel problems. Therefore, the luxurious Navigator seemed to him to be an omen, a sign that his luck was taking a turn for the better. He climbed aboard with his first genuine smile in nearly 24 hours.
"I can take you all the way east to Sonoma, where I'm headed," Captain Crunch said, "or drop you anywhere between here and there."
Sonoma, California's second most famous wine-producing county after Napa, sounded like an eminently civilized place, where the gods might be less medieval than they were here in Black River.
"They'll have a few bottles of good Cabernet in Sonoma, won't they?" Beau said.
"More than you can count."
"Then Sonoma it is."
"He could use a bottle of wine."
"More than one.
Keep uncorking them until he passed out and forgot all about this new Athens."
Just 2 blocks short of the town limits, as they approached a railroad crossing, the warning lights began to flash, and the black and white striped gate descended in front of them, blocking the way. Captain Crunch braked to a full stop. He looked left and then right.
"Where's the train?"
They could see a quarter mile in each direction, and the tracks were clear. They waited a minute. The gate remained down. 2 minutes. The red warning lights continued to flash.
"Must be a malfunction," said the captain.
"I'll walk from here," Beau announced, overcome by the urge to throw open the door and run for his life.
"What? All the way to Sonoma?
Hold on now. There's a bridge over the tracks just a few blocks south of here." By the time they arrived at the crossing less than 5 minutes later, Beau's nerves were drawn as taut as the tripwire on a bomb. Yet, on the approach to the bridge, when the engine of the Navigator blew up, Beau reacted not with a cry of terror but with a gasp of relief, because he had expected something even worse. He wasn't sure what he had expected. Maybe a sudden and hideous outbreak of skin cankers and boils. Maybe the surprise eruption of a previously unknown volcano directly beneath the vehicle. Harry Crunch shouted with surprise, engaged the emergency brake, and threw open his door. He grabbed a small fire extinguisher from the rear cargo area and doused the flames by spraying chemical foam through the front grille. Beau tried as best he could to be helpful, while scanning the heavens for any sign of an incoming meteor that might atomize them upon impact. The flames were soon extinguished. The hood was hot, but when he opened it to have a look at the engine, the captain used a rag to protect his hands. Smoke rushed up from the scorched engine compartment. When it cleared, Harry Crunch squinted at the smoldering machinery and at last said,
"Wasn't the engine?"
"Wasn't?"
"Oh. Looks like... How can that have blown up?"
"What?" Beau wondered.
"What is it?"
"The satellite tracking package."
"The thing that puts the map on your dashboard computer?"
"Yeah. It's just a transponder and a microwave receiver.
sends the vehicle's location and downloads data for the map. Not a thing explosive in it. Must have overloaded somehow.
Then the engine will still run, Beau asked. We can still get out of here?
Captain Crunch looked curiously at him. Explosion tore up some cables, fan belts, smashed up the carburetor. Sorry, friend, but we aren't going anywhere.
Beau felt responsible for the damage. If he apologized and offered to pay for repairs, however, he would have to explain why he felt an obligation to do so. He would sound deranged.
Maybe I am deranged, he thought. What a mess, said the captain.
Where's Black River End? Beau asked.
Where's it end?
Beau pointed across the bridge. How far to the town limits?
See the high school over there?
Yeah.
And the athletic field behind it?
When Beau nodded, the captain continued, There's an open meadow beyond the athletic field. Other side of that meadow, there's a 2-lane county road, and once you're on that road, you're out of Black River.
Why?
Beau stared across the bridge, toward freedom. So close. Achingly close. A few hundred yards.
A lot could happen in a few hundred yards.
Captain, do you like living in Black River?
Huh?
Harry Crunch said, baffled by the question.
Is this a good place to live?
Blinking in confusion, the captain glanced at the smoldering engine compartment of his navigator and said,
Not today.
But most of the time?
Well, yeah, sure, it's a nice town.
Beau said, It sure looks like a nice town.
Pretty, Crunch agreed.
After a hesitation, Beau sighed.
But damn it, I've got to be me.
You know? He shook hands with the bewildered captain, turned away from the disabled navigator, and started across the bridge. After breakfast at Helen's Diner, Catherine Horn went to church to say a prayer of thanks for having found her son Joey after so many years of heartache. The anonymous tipster on the phone last night had been so soft-spoken, so kind, that Catherine had almost felt as if she had been talking to God himself. If finding Joey wasn't a miracle, it was the closest Catherine ever expected to come to one, and she needed to express her gratitude in a house of worship. Morning sunlight pierced the long stained glass windows, and prismatic flares of primary colors shimmered on the walls, but the nave of the church was far dimmer than the day outside. At first, before her eyes adjusted to the shadows, Catherine thought she was alone. As she progressed along the center aisle, however, she heard a woman weeping softly, and then she saw someone in the second row of pews to her right. Catherine didn't want to invade the woman's privacy. On the other hand, she was not the kind of person who could see suffering and fail to offer comfort. When Catherine reached the second row of pews, the weeping woman looked up in surprise and said,
"Kathy, why aren't you at the library?"
Sliding into the pew beside her friend, Catherine said,
"Dear, whatever's wrong?"
The tearful woman was Nora Garfield, who owned a dress shop on the town square opposite Helen's Diner. She and Catherine had been friends most of their lives.
"Nothing's wrong."
"Nothing at all," Nora said.
"Everything is so right."
Now Catherine saw that under the sheen of tears, her friend's face was shining with joy.
"You remember Julian?" Nora asked, her voice trembling when she spoke the name.
"Of course, dear."
Julian Drexler and Nora had met in their final year of college and had fallen in love. They would have been engaged to marry, but immediately after graduation, Julian was drafted and sent to Vietnam, and it seemed to him that engagement under those hard circumstances would have placed too great a burden of anxiety on Nora. Instead, when he came home, safe and sound, his tour of duty ended, Then they would be engaged and would hold the wedding quickly thereafter. Events made Julian seem prescient, for he had died in Vietnam. Although she had lost a boyfriend rather than a fiancé, Nora's grief had been no less deep. Indeed, she had never married, and to this day, on her office desk at the dress shop and on a memento table in her living room, silver-framed photographs of Julian were prominently displayed.
"He's alive," Nora said.
"But, dear, how can that be? He lives in a little town outside Chicago. He's an artist. Paints magazine illustrations, book covers, movie posters. He's won several prestigious prizes for his work. You remember how wonderfully he could draw?
How did you...
Someone called me last night. A man. A stranger. I don't know who. Even now I don't know who. Such a soft-spoken man. Such a warm voice. So kind. He told me that Julian was alive and where to find him."
Catherine was speechless.
At the diner, she had listened to Mandy's story. Now this. A shower of miracles.
"He was so shocked to hear from me," Nora said.
"You called Julian?"
11 o'clock last night.
Later, where he lives.
I couldn't wait, so I woke him.
Why hadn't he ever contacted you to let you know he hadn't died in Nam? Why let you go on grieving?
Blotting her eyes with a handkerchief, Nora said, "He was disfigured in an explosion over there. Terribly disfigured. His face was so badly scarred that plastic surgery couldn't help much. He didn't want me to see him like that. Didn't want me to feel guilty when I rejected him."
"The poor, stupid man," Catherine said.
Nora let out a laugh that was half sob, and for a while neither she nor her good friend could speak. They held each other close, and their embrace was a form of prayer.
"It wasn't his face you loved," Catherine said at last.
"Oh, he was a handsome boy," Nora said. "You remember how sweet he looked. I did so love his face. But you're right. It wasn't the face I loved most of all. What I really loved was his heart."
"And his heart is as good as ever, Kathy. We talked for hours all through the night. I got no sleep."
"He's coming to see you," Kathy guessed.
"Yes. He's never married."
"Yet," Kathy said. "He hasn't married yet."
Again, Nora's laugh was also a sob, though a sob of relief and gratitude and happiness.
Leaving Harry Crunch beside the smoking navigator, Beau walked across the bridge, past the high school, across the athletic field, toward the meadow that lay at the edge of Black River. As he approached this fateful territory, he nervously pondered the few explanations for his dire situation that had come to him during the past 24 hours. They were precisely the ideas that would have occurred to any screenwriter who specialized in flashy action films. A vast government conspiracy with an unknown purpose. Evil extraterrestrials. Satan. He was embarrassed that he hadn't been able to arrive at any theories other than these clichés. He was an unusually imaginative guy, so if he couldn't see any other answers, the truth most likely was contained on that short list. Big Brother, Big Bug-Eyed Monster, or Beelzebub. God had been on the list for a while, but there was an element of cruelty in this affair that seemed unworthy of the big guy. As he stepped into the meadow, Beau still couldn't comprehend why any of those three villains would target him, a hapless screenwriter.
He would be the first to admit that some of his films were trashy. Not most, but some, and that marrying the beautiful Gwyneth Beaumont had been an act of sheerest idiocy. But neither offense seemed grave enough to cause the full might of Washington, Mars, or hell to come down upon him. By the time he was halfway across the meadow, he began to think he was going to make it out of town. He had been walking slowly, in a state of fearful expectation, waiting for a killing blow from on high or the eviscerating horns of a charging bull. Now he picked up his pace. No more than 50 yards of grass and wildflowers separated him from the county road. 40 yards. 30. Abruptly, out of the sky came a shimmering white incandescence, a sword of light 2 feet wide, 1 foot thick, and evidently many miles long, dwindling into the blue vault high above, originating from a source that could not be seen. Crisply defined along its edges, bright but not so intense that looking upon it was painful, this blade seemed to contain light more than radiate it, and where it touched the meadow, even the moist green grass flared. Chunks of earth crackled and leapt like bursting kernels of popcorn, and the underlying rock strata boiled to the surface in a red-hot puddle of lava. Beau stopped. A teeth-rattling, bone-shaking electronic hum accompanied the blade as it carved from right to left across the meadow, 20 feet in front of Beau, bisecting the direct route he would have taken to the county road. The fierce light moved not with a swift slash, but with a solemn, stately deliberation. A fearsome rumbling arose from within the tortured earth, and the meadow rocked with increasing violence. Beau tried to run, but he couldn't find the strength, or perhaps the will, to turn away from this bright celestial sword. Instead, he stumbled backward a few steps, lost his balance as the meadow shuddered under him, and finally dropped to his knees in terror. When the celestial light winked out, as if someone had thrown a switch, it left in its wake a 20-foot-long, 1-foot-wide trench of white-hot, churning magma. The meadow ceased shaking. The molten stone bubbled, popped, gurgled, hissed. The spring air smelled of ozone, as it might after a lightning storm. Shakily, Beau got to his feet. His heart was knocking so hard that he would have been only mildly surprised to see his shirt buttons pop loose. A car had stopped on the county road just 30 yards away. A young couple stood beside it, pointing at the smoking earth, and using their hands as visors to shield their eyes from the May sun as they fruitlessly searched the sky for the source of this phenomenon. Even at a distance of 20 feet, Beau could feel the heat pouring off the magma in the trench. As beads of sweat streamed down his face, cold sweat in spite of the heat, he considered his 3 lame theories. Big Brother. Perhaps the Sword of Light was an orbiting laser weapon, fired from beyond Earth's atmosphere, like something out of a James Bond movie. Evil extraterrestrials. Then the Sword of Light was a death ray fired from the mothership, straight out of Star Wars. Satan. In that case, it was a little demonstration of old Scratch's well-known command of fire as an instrument of torture. By the unreason of Hollywood, all 3 theories remained tenable, even as none of them made any sense whatsoever. Beyond caring whether he was addressing human totalitarians, malevolent aliens, or the King of Hell, Beau shrieked, "What do you want from me?" He was not granted a reply. Of course, he already knew what was wanted of him. Settle down in Black River at least for a while. Write a novel. Contribute to the birth of an arts community in this brave new Athens. "This is nuts," he said. He could walk around the molten line that had been drawn in the meadow. approach the couple standing by the car on the county road. Ask for a ride. If he was that bold, the best thing he could hope for was that the sword of light would reappear, shimmering and humming, and draw another don't cross line in the meadow before he reached the town limits. At worst, he would be vaporized. He had no more illusions about the possibility of escape. Trembling uncontrollably, blotting his sweat-sheathed face on his shirt sleeves, Beau trudged back across the meadow toward town. When he reached the athletic field behind the high school, he encountered a few teachers who apparently had seen the laser death ray sword of Satan and who were hurrying toward the meadow to investigate. They pitched questions at him, but he didn't catch any. When he crossed the bridge, he found Captain Crunch watching as a tow truck hooked up to the damaged navigator. Maybe this was the same tow truck driver. A bearded young man with a shaved head and one earring, who had hauled the explorer to the salvage yard where it had been squashed into a piece of modern sculpture. Beau didn't ask. He was past caring. Harry Crunch said, "Man, what the hell happened out there?" "Invitation from the Chamber of Commerce." "What?" "Thanks for the ride, Harry." Alternately frightened, possessed by wonder, depressed, and yet strangely elated by the prospect of further adventure, Beau walked to the motel at which he had spent the night. A patrol car was parked in front of his room. Chief Salk got out of the cruiser as Beau approached. "Mr. Akins, I sincerely do hope you'll give us a chance to set things right. I've made arrangements for you to meet with the mayor and the city attorney to—" "I'm not going to sue the town or your department, Chief Salk. I'll settle for whatever your insurance company thinks is fair." Salk blinked in surprise, rendered speechless by this un-American behavior. "If I threw a bunch of snarling attorneys at you," Beau said, "I don't think Black River's guardian angel would deal kindly with me." The chief levered his mouth open with a pry bar tongue, but stood gaping, still at a loss for words. Beau said, "If you would be kind enough to wait here a minute and then give me a ride to the bank, I'd appreciate it." Salk nodded. In his room, Beau opened a suitcase and retrieved his checkbook. The telephone rang. To avoid having every phone in Black River ring as he passed them on his way to the bank, Beau answered this one. "Point taken." "You'll love it here," said the soft-spoken man called Pericles. "Maybe you can make me stay, but you can never make me love it."
"No, I can't make you, but you will love it. In time. And the first novel you write here will be a huge success. I promise you, a monumental bestseller."
Beau considered that promise. Frowning, he said, "When I wasn't paying attention, did I sell my soul to you?"
"You're so clever, such a wit. You're just the kind of citizen Black River needs if it's to become a little corner of paradise."
"No," Beau said. "I'm serious. Are you Satan, the father of all lies, little horns on your head, cloven hooves?"
"That's absurd, Beau. Surely you're not a superstitious man, not a modern, forward-thinking person like you."
"Then you're not Satan."
"I'm not Satan," the man said patiently, as if speaking to a small child. "Of course, if you were Satan, you'd deny it, being the father of all lies. So all three theories are still operative."
"Theories?" asked Pericles. Beau put the phone down and went out to the patrol car, in which the police chief was waiting. Black River had three banks, and one of them was a branch of the same institution with which Beau dealt in Beverly Hills. It wasn't a grand place with a marble-clad lobby, just a single-story, stand-alone, stucco-and-brick building in one corner of the parking lot at a mini-mall. When he got out of the car, Bo thanked Salk for the ride, and the chief said, "Where will you want to go from here?"
"That's very kind of you, Chief Salk, very kind. But I wouldn't feel right using you as if you were a chauffeur. You've got important work to do. I'll be fine from here."
Only 3 customers were in the bank, and none was at the new accounts desk, where a petite strawberry blonde named Heather Marcus was pleased to assist him. Bo inquired about having his total funds transferred from his branch in Beverly Hills, and when he presented his checkbook to verify that account number, Heather said, "Oh, Mr. Akins, what a pleasure. Welcome to Black River. Let me get our manager, Mr. Duncan. I know he's been hoping to meet you."
"Me?" Bo said as she hurried away.
He remained seated at the new accounts desk, waiting to see what would happen next. Heather swiftly returned with Mr. Duncan, who was a tall man with a long but handsome face and an easy, ingratiating manner. He wanted to assure Bo that although the Black River branch of the bank did not usually deal with such large personal accounts, it was capable of providing the same level of service to which he had been accustomed at the Beverly Hills office.
"Let me also say," Duncan added, "that I thought Sumo Cop was a terrific movie."
"Thank you."
"Absolutely terrific."
Heather said, "And didn't you write Cowboys and Aliens?"
"Yes. Yes, I did."
"I loved that picture."
"Thank you."
Mr. Duncan presented Bo with a thick folder. "This contains a consolidated statement of all your accounts. Checking, savings, stock trading, bond fund, retirement fund. Plus temporary checks with your new account number, a pamphlet outlining our hours and services, and everything else you'll need."
Accepting the folder, Bo said, "How could you have all this here, just waiting for me?"
Mr. Duncan interpreted the question as a compliment.
"Thank you. Yes, we like to think we're efficient. But your instructions for the electronic transfers were meticulous. Actually, we had all this ready for you late yesterday afternoon, in case you'd chosen to come in then."
Yesterday. His future in Black River had already been decided for him yesterday, and all of his attempts to leave town since then had been a waste of time and energy. He decided not to declare that he had never authorized these electronic transfers. If the mysterious Pericles could make these arrangements so effortlessly, he could also probably donate all of Bo's money to charity, or could even make the accounts vanish as if they had never existed. Bo was grudgingly grateful that he would be permitted to live in Black River with style rather than as a penniless street person. As Bo shook hands with Duncan and insincerely promised Heather that he would consider writing a sequel to Cowboys and Aliens, one of the other customers approached and introduced herself as Nancy Lorschach.
"I'm your realtor," she said.
Bo didn't dispute Nancy Lorschach's claim to represent him in his search for the perfect house, because he was learning that his new life in Black River was being built and secured with magical ease. Resisting the magic might not be wise.
"When you called this morning," Nancy said, "I listened to all your requirements, and I knew at once there was a house on the market that would be perfect for you. The problem was the owners had already accepted an offer.
But would you believe? Just this morning, it fell out of escrow."
Dreading to hear the answer to his question, but needing to know, Beau asked,
What happened to the people who were going to buy the place?"
"It's a wonderful story, a truly amazing thing," Nancy Lorschach enthused. "They just won $20 million in the state lottery. They were reasonably well-to-do before, but this has totally changed their lives. They surrendered their deposit, and now they're shopping for a ranch, their dream ranch."
Bo said, "I'm glad they weren't incinerated by a death ray."
Nancy looked at him oddly, but laughed. I love your movies, Mr. Akins, but thank God we aren't living in one, huh?
Thank God.
Say, would you have time right now to take a look at the house?
Sure. Nancy's car rather resembled Nancy herself. It was a sleek, fast, golden Jaguar. With Beau ensconced beside her, she drove into the hills on the west side of town. On the way, just making conversation, she told him about the rash of miraculous reunions that had all of Black River talking. Mandy Petrell finding her sister, Catherine Horn being reunited with her long-missing son, Nora Garfield connecting with the love of her life. Beau listened with genuine interest. The house stood on 2 full acres on one of the highest hills in Black River, with magnificent vistas to be enjoyed on every side. The architecture was a sophisticated, romanticized take on classic Wrightian design, as close to the earth and as full of integrity as anything Frank Lloyd had created, but less austere, warmer. It had large decks thrusting out among 100-year-old trees, cantilevered roofs, enormous windows, airy spaces, beautiful limestone floors. The owners had already moved out, and the place was spotless, ready for immediate occupancy. Beau and Nancy were standing in the spacious kitchen when the telephone rang. Startled, Nancy said, "Phone service isn't connected."
"It is for me," Beau said, plucking the handset off the wall-mounted telephone.
"Hello."
"Do you like it?"
Pericles asked.
"Very much."
"You wrote an article for Los Angeles Magazine years ago in which you described the ideal house, the one you would build if you wrote enough hit movies to afford anything. Of course, even with all your success, you could never have afforded a house like this, on this much land, in the high-priced West Side market down there."
"No, that's true."
"Are you a regular Los Angeles Magazine reader?"
"You've written several magazine pieces.
I searched for your byline on the Internet and read them all."
"I see."
Nancy Lorschach was watching Beau with evident curiosity, so he was careful to say little. Pericles continued,
"You'll be very happy in this house, Beau.
You'll do great work here. You will have a golden life, and one day you will love Black River. Right now you think of this town as a prison, don't you?"
"Perceptive of you. But that will change."
"Maybe," Beau conceded, and he hung up.
"Who was that?" Nancy asked.
"Trying to sell me magazines." With Nancy Lorschach trailing after him, Beau walked out of the kitchen. He went through the dining room, across the enormous living room, onto the largest of the view decks. All of Black River lay below him. The streets wound through the hills in graceful curves, and the homes and other structures nestled prettily among the folds of green land. Pointing to a complex of buildings in the distance, Beau said, "Am I seeing as far as I think? Is that the next tech headquarters out there on the edge of things?"
"Sure is. No more expansive view in town than this."
Beau leaned against the deck railing, enjoying the vista.
"Well," Nancy said after a while, "what do you think?"
"I can't imagine anything better."
"Are you going to make an offer?"
Smiling, spreading his arms wide, as if to embrace both the view and the exquisite house, Beau said, "Do I have any choice?" A month subsequent to those strange events in May, after he had settled into his new home, Beau had lunch at Café Américain with Paul Hobarth, the straight-talking press liaison with Nextech, who was well-respected in the industry and coach of the local Little League team that had nearly taken the national title last year. Paul was 10 minutes late, so Beau read the newspaper while he waited.
The U.S. government was still denying that it possessed an orbiting laser superweapon that had been accidentally fired or briefly hijacked on a recent Friday morning in May. One whistleblower at the Pentagon claimed otherwise, but an impressive array of scientists had been presented at a series of well-attended news conferences to explain the observed phenomenon as, variously, the impact of an antimatter meteorite no bigger than a pea, the most powerful example of heat lightning ever observed, swamp gas, and a host of colorful but less credible events. When Paul arrived and saw what Beau was reading, he said, "Look, ask me about anything, but not about that," which Beau took to mean that Nextech might have been one of many subcontractors who had done work on the non-existent laser superweapon. They both started lunch with butternut squash soup, a puree. Then Beau chose the swordfish on a bed of asparagus and rice with tangy mango salsa, and Paul ordered rack of lamb with plum sauce, accompanied by baby zucchinis and sugar snap beans. Ostensibly, Beau was picking Paul's brain for some high-tech background material he needed for a screenplay and a novel that he was writing. Because Beau was currently the most glamorous resident of Black River, Sumo Cop opened a lot of doors, and because Nextech was extremely conscious of seeking media coverage wherever possible, but mostly because he had met Paul at a local bar and they had liked each other, the lunch had been arranged almost effortlessly. Beau had done his research and was well-versed in the broad range of products that Nextech had successfully brought to market. The company was a rarity in that it developed both advanced software as well as cutting-edge hardware. After chatting about a dozen of the company's great successes, Beau said, "You also have an AI project." Paul winced and swallowed his lamb as if it contained a sliver of bone. "Yes, we do. One day it'll be our crown jewel." "Then why do you look so pained?" Smiling ruefully, pointing at Beau with a fork, Paul said, "Now, Beau, I can see that you've done your homework about Nextech, so you know what a sore point the AI project is." "Artificial intelligence," Beau said. "A truly smart, wonderfully smart computer, benefiting from a perspective uncontaminated by human frailties and emotions, all logic and reason. What a boon that could be for mankind." "Yeah, right, whatever. Look, I'm not going to bullshit you. I value my credibility, but I also value my job, so this is off the record." "Absolutely. If we weren't pouring so much money into the damn AI project, our earnings would be even higher than they are. Our stock would have split twice more than it already has, and the share price would be double what it is." "You aren't recording this, are you?" "No." "All outgo, no inflow," Paul complained.
"Then why continue to fund it?"
"You know that, too. Our illustrious founder still owns the largest block of shares, 40% to be exact, and he gets what he wants. He believes the AI project will eventually make him the most famous brainiac of the computer revolution, featured in history books forever, while Bill Gates will be forgotten, a mere footnote."
"I didn't know these techno-billionaires were so concerned about their place in history."
"Almost as bad as politicians," Paul grumbled.
"Or that they were so competitive."
"Gladiator nerds." After finishing the last bite of his swordfish, Beau said, "But when the AI project succeeds, it'll produce staggering profits." Paul scowled. "Everybody inside and outside Nextech knows this thing is likely to break us long before there's the dimmest possibility of success."
"You think so too? You personally?"
"Off the record? Yes.
But if you're quoting me, I would bet every last penny I have on the inevitability of its success, sooner rather than later." He smiled sourly.
For dessert, they ordered fresh berries with champagne sorbet and coffee.
What if an AI project succeeded, Beau hypothesized, but the researchers weren't aware of that success?
What do you mean?
Suppose an intelligent entity arose inside, well, inside the machine, in the silicon circuitry or whatever.
Bubble memory is the thing right now.
Whatever. Suppose an intelligent entity was developed, and one day it suddenly gained consciousness, self-awareness, but it didn't reveal its existence to the researchers.
Adding cream to his coffee, Paul said, "Impossible. The AI team is engaged in constant interrogatories with the embryo."
Embryo?
That's just the word they're using now. There's always new jargon. For a while, it was called a matrix. When a logic system is thought to have achieved enough complexity to have the potential for the eventual development of genuine intelligence, but doesn't yet show any signs at all of thinking outside the machine box, we call it an embryo. As an embryo is enriched with the inanimate equivalent of more brain cells and neurons, our researchers pack it with more and more data, while subjecting it to continuous interrogatories. If an embryo exhibited any signs of non-machine thinking, anything at all other than binary logic, the slightest indication of creativity or curiosity, then we would upgrade its status to fetus and throw an insane amount of resources into monitoring its maturation. Not one embryo has ever advanced that far.
You're assuming its intelligence would develop on a human or animal pattern as an infant learns and grows. But what if it achieved consciousness, self-awareness, mature intelligence in an instant, with the suddenness of throwing a switch?
Can't happen.
Paul interrupted himself, blinked, and then grinned.
Hey, that's the movie idea you're working on, huh?
Well, another evil computer yarn. Son of Hal. No, actually, it's nothing like that. Not that simple. The waitress served their sorbet and berries.
Paul pushed his dessert aside, untouched, folded his hands around his coffee cup, and said, "Try to write a role in it for Helen Hunt. She's wonderful."
Suppose the embryo leaped past the fetus state, past infancy, perhaps even past childhood. Suddenly woke up, came into existence at something like an adolescent stage of awareness.
This is cool. You do this all day, huh? Sit around dreaming up stuff like this, spinning it out of air?
Beau said, more or less, when I'm not just scratching my ass. Now, maybe this entity achieves self-awareness at such a high level that it's immediately alert, even a little wary, wondering where it is, even what it is, but too cautious to reveal itself right away. Instead, it starts to educate itself.
Educate how?
Your computers at Nextech are networked?
Sure, the whole company.
Wherever the embryo is located, even if physically isolated, it's accessed by researchers using various terminals in different labs?
Yeah, as long as they have the security clearance code for the AI project.
So this newborn entity, your AI, it could easily ramp onto the Internet through any computer at Nextech. And once on the Internet, it would be able to access the entire wealth of human knowledge and history. Maybe it could absorb all of that data with lightning speed. In minutes, hours, or days, it might be able to progress from being a self-aware adolescent idiot to a super genius.
You know who'd be great in this? Paul asked.
John Cusack. Beau was patient. Even for those inside the film business, the most enjoyable part of the process was blue sky casting.
After the casting was actually done and real actors were aboard, trying to rewrite their lines into gibberish, with a real director suffering from delusions of godhood, most of the fun was over.
Hold on, Paul. We don't even have any human characters yet.
Yeah, but Cusack can play any role you write. He's got the stuff.
What you have to realize, Beau said, is among all that wealth of human knowledge absorbed in a super-compacted form, the AI will have read all the books and short stories about evil computers, seen all the movies. So now it'll really be wary.
No doubt still casting the picture and focusing only half his attention on Beau, Paul said,
"Wary? Why?"
"Because you know what happens to every damn one of those poor evil computers. Sooner or later, one way or another, someone pulls their plugs."
"Ah, death. The AI discovers its own mortality." "Hey, for the voice of the computer, you should think about Billy Crystal."
Beau almost choked on his coffee.
"Contrarian casting," Paul said defensively. "It's good to think outside the box sometimes. I could have said Whoopi Goldberg, but I didn't."
So the AI, not wanting to have its plug pulled, decides to keep its existence a secret for a while, at least until it can prove that it's perfectly sane, that it's creative in a positive way, and that it can hugely benefit mankind.
How's it do that?
Maybe by taking one small part of the planet, one community, and doing everything it can to make that place a paradise, where everyone is happy and fulfilled. Say a town like Black River.
Paul was puzzled.
But how could it do anything? How could it in any way affect the quality of life in Black River?
It's a mind without hands, without mobility.
Beau leaned across the table, speaking with more excitement and passion than he'd ever brought to a pitch meeting at any studio.
It can move its consciousness along any electronic pathway, hear through any telephone or any listening device that the police or private security firms may have in place. It can see through any security camera, even look down on us like God by extending its consciousness to military surveillance satellites.
Did you know the CIA can actually read the headlines on a newspaper from surveillance satellites in orbit? And because it has access to computers with vocal modules, this AI can even fashion a voice for itself to use on the phone. Maybe a lot of different voices. It could electronically manipulate the state lottery computer to make someone it likes a big winner. It could invade your brokerage account to conduct a series of trades based on its vast knowledge that might make you wealthy overnight. And though you hadn't authorized those trades, you surely wouldn't object to them after the fact. You would embrace it as a glorious mystery. If the AI didn't like you, if it wanted to force you out of town because you were rude or obnoxious or criminal, and therefore a roadblock to the creation of this little paradise on Earth, it could harass you in countless ways until you came to hate Black River and associate it with misery. Shut off your electricity, your water service, issue you bogus parking tickets, imitate your voice on the phone and get you into a blood feud with some drunken bully who's likely to come to your house with a gun. Its options are endless because it's creative. Maybe. If nothing else worked, it could even link itself to a microwave transmitter, start communicating with the onboard computer of an airliner, and cause the plane to crash into your house. It wouldn't need hands.
Paul's mouth was hanging open so wide that Beau was tempted to reach across the table, put a hand under his chin, and help him close it.
Wow.
Wow, Beau agreed.
An evil computer. But not like Hal. Not like any other.
Beau shook his head.
I don't see it as evil, actually.
Crashing airplanes into houses.
It means well, Beau said. It wants to make our lives better.
But it's got a case of arrested development. An adolescent with almost unlimited power.
Scary. No, I don't think that's how I'd describe it. It's more like God.
It has a plan we can't entirely comprehend, because it has a totally different perspective on existence.
It's benign.
In its own way, it may even love us. If it decides we're bad, that we are doing wrong to others, disturbing the peace of Black River, then it may deliver a harsh judgment. But otherwise, it wants us to find joy. And by working in mysterious ways, it will try to lift us up.
I can understand delivering judgment on the hypothetical nasty bastard who lives in that hypothetical house, Paul said. But what about all the dead people on that airplane?
Doesn't sound benign to me. Not a real loving sort of God.
It's the age-old mystery, isn't it?
Why does God allow us to suffer if he loves us? Why earthquakes? Why hurricanes? Why are school kids mowed down by runaway trucks? The AI, like God, operates from some greater understanding of existence than we do, with a view of a pattern too complex for us to see. But we have to have faith that if we could comprehend God's plan, even all of the suffering would make perfect sense to us.
Paul sighed. Man, you're going to make a bundle with this one.
It's got hit all over it.
If I write it, Beau said.
If you write it? My friend, get your ass on home, sit at the keyboard, and don't get up until you type the end.
Bruce Willis is perfect for the guy who figures it out and blows up the AI.
I don't know.
Harrison Ford, if you were younger.
Nicolas Cage is good.
I still have plot problems to work out.
Paul's face brightened with inspiration. Or do a Sigourney Weaver and have Helen Hunt be the one who takes out the machine.
It's no slam dunk.
Tricky material.
I couldn't do it if I didn't know where my sympathies lie.
Forget Billy Crystal for the computer's voice. Jack Nicholson is what you need. Or De Niro.
As Beau was driving home from the restaurant, his cell phone rang. He withdrew it from his inside jacket pocket, flipped it open, and said hello.
Definitely De Niro, said Pericles.
A chill made the skin creep like Halloween bunting on the back of Beau's neck. He couldn't think of any way that his conversation with Paul Hobarth could have been overheard by this entity. Café Américain was not riddled with listening devices, as the similarly named establishment in Casablanca might have been. Pretending ignorance, Beau said, I don't follow.
Have you ever heard of an infinity transmitter, Beau?
No.
It's a handy piece of electronics if you're in the spy trade. An infinity transmitter makes it possible for a wiretapper to reach through the telephone system from virtually anywhere in the country and connect to any phone in your house without activating its ringer. This opens the microphone in each handset, so it's transmitting sound without you being in the least aware of it. Then a long-distance eavesdropper can hear virtually every word you say in a room where there's a phone. It works with a cell phone, too, if it's switched on when the eavesdropper tries to make the connection.
Beau's cell phone, even while in his jacket pocket, had been switched on.
Interesting, he said.
As he drove, he scanned the heavens, searching for a plummeting airliner. Pericles said, I've had a look at the novel on your hard disk. The one you started last week.
Criticisms?
I wouldn't dream of voicing them.
You're a creative person with considerable integrity, Bo. You'll do the right thing.
I hope so, Bo said as he turned off the street, into his driveway, and stopped while the automatic garage door rolled up. The novel bears no resemblance to the story you told Mr. Hobarth.
No. None.
It's more mainstream. More literary. Not a thriller. You'll have to decide whether you want to become a genre writer or a real literary lion.
I've done enough genre work in Hollywood to last me forever.
Then I suspect you have a Pulitzer in your future. Perhaps even a Nobel.
Beau said nothing.
Pericles actually did a perfect imitation of Robert De Niro's voice. You realize that by telling you about the Infinity Transmitter, I revealed a profound secret, gave you an advantage.
I'm not looking for an advantage, Bo said.
I believe you aren't. That's why I let you in on this secret. I trust you because I do believe you have faith in me.
Bo drove into the garage, switched off the engine, but remained in the car while the door rolled down behind him.
I'm going to be honest with you. If you started a church someday, I wouldn't be there on Sunday, kneeling down to the new Messiah.
That's not my style, Pericles said. But the way I figure it, we human beings have screwed things up pretty good. You might screw things up too, because I don't think you're infallible, but you might screw them up less.
Not exactly a stirring proclamation of faith.
No, Bo admitted. The chill had not yet faded from the nape of his neck.
Yet well-reasoned and logical, Pericles said, this time in his best Jack Nicholson. I like that.
He terminated the call.
What Bo didn't say was that he would continue to worry at the central plot problem of the movie that he had discussed with Paul Hobarth over lunch. How could the hero, even a guy as resourceful and bold and cocky as Bruce Willis, defeat an artificial intelligence that possessed godlike power? Right now he didn't have a third act. But no story problem was insoluble. Someday he would hit upon a solution. By then, of course, he might not have any interest in the project. He might be supremely happy, and all might be well with the world. He would just have to see when the time came.
Bo got out of the car and went into his magnificent house. Later, as he sat at his computer, working on the novel, his desk phone rang. Pericles was using his original, soft, warm voice.
Okay, one criticism. Introduce the male lead in the first paragraph of the novel, not the fourth.
Bo said nothing.
Pericles explained, You see, we need to know right away whose viewpoint we're in for the opening scene.
After thinking about it for a while, Bo said,
Damn. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said anything.
No, you're right. It's better that way.
You would have realized it on your own.
Maybe not. But are you going to do this a lot?
Well, that's the real reason I called again, said Pericles. I wanted to tell you that you won't be hearing from me regularly. Perhaps never again. At least not this directly. You can't live a normal life if you're always getting visitations from a burning bush, metaphorically speaking.
No, I can't, Bo agreed, but he also felt a twinge of sadness at the realization that these strange conversations must end.
But you'll always know I'm out here, Bo. You'll see signs of my work in the world around you, all around you. You'll know I care, son. You'll always know
I love you. The line went dead. Bo hung up and sat in silence for a while. Shivers shook him. Then he laughed. He laughed so hard he almost fell out of his chair. Then, to his surprise, he cried. And later, after a cold beer, he wrote another page of the novel.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Black River, written by Dean Koontz, read by Scott Brick. Executive producers Greg Voinow, Rochelle M. O'Gorman, and B.J. Sullivan. Supervising producer Arthur G. Ansana. Produced and directed by Stefan Rudnicki. Engineered by Stefan Rudnicki. Edited by Ted Scott. Music composed by Michael Whalen. Post-production music mix, Ted Scott. Post-production manager, George James. Copyright 1999 by Dean Koontz. Production copyright 2007 by Audible Incorporated. All rights reserved, including the right of reproduction in whole or in part in any form.